I'm assuming when we put this title up here for this class that doesn't take a great deal of discussion for us to know that there is a difference between the viewpoint of this and this where it comes to this. I mean, that's that in our court system right now, and in our political system, and in all of that, we who are Christians are increasingly in the minority when it comes to our understanding, not about how to make marriage work, or not about how to deal with problems in marriage or whatever, but what marriage is. And one of the dangers is that we end up either sort of chameleon-like adapting to the culture, or monk-like withdrawing from the culture and calling the culture names, and not thinking about what the Christian mind on this matter is. And that's the direction that we'd like to try to go. I have a collector of articles, and I try to kind of keep up with what goes on in news settings in that way here. And I brought a couple I'd like to start with today to ask you to see what you think about these. One of them is actually from the Christian Chronicle, a newspaper type format done by members of the church. And this is an editorial written by Brother Lynn MacMillan. Brother MacMillan has been here before our congregation, and kind of focuses on family stuff. That's his teaching field. And he's commenting about the Supreme Court cases, the two of them, which are have already been argued and are being decided right now. And he says that society has judged on these questions right now, same-sex marriage and so forth. And he says a recent Washington Post ABC News poll showed that 58% of respondents and 80% of adults under age 30 approve of same-sex marriage. Now, I want you to think of that, 80%, which tells you that either in academia or in entertainment or in the Facebook, Twitter world, the information is garnered by people in this age group, and that the choice is made not on the basis of what moral outlooks based in authority outside the individual, like Scripture. The choice is not made on that basis, but instead on the basis of not being judgmental. In other words, a value has been determined in our culture that not being judgmental, which is defined as not saying that anything is right or wrong in and of itself, that is more important than any standard or tradition that has to do with how family is formed and how family operates. Which means that in our culture, we have grown progressively more comfortable with the idea that human history until this generation can be cast off with no consequence. Now, you ought to, any of us who are prone to the non-judgmental thing ought to think about what we are saying in this process. We are arrogantly saying that no one until our generation knew anything about how to live. Now just think of that. That's what we're saying. In the name of being non-judgmental. All right, let me progress with the article. Forgive me for stopping to preach. All right. Brother McMillan says that he cites David Frum, who is a CNN contributor. He says in an opinion piece he wrote, he says that while straight young Americans support marriage for gays, increasingly they opt against marriage for themselves. He cites a report by academics and social activists that shows that 48% of first-time mothers in the U.S. are unwed. And for the first time in the country's history, the median age of women having babies is lower than the median age of marriage. And that's by a year, basically. You consider the consequences of this and how it is possible. And Brother McMillan says, we used to lament the notion that our society had exchanged as long as we both shall live for as long as we both shall love. And in truth, and here's what I want you to think about. In truth, both of these phrases have been exchanged for nothing at all. America's gay community is fighting for access to a word, marriage, that secular society has rendered all but meaningless. Isn't that an odd, an ironic thing, that at the same moment, argument over whether this word can be applied to same-sex relationships, this relationship is being largely ignored as being a basis for child rearing and for family life. Isn't that odd? Such is the road that culture goes down. I'll cite our other article if I have time in a minute here. Okay. Now, what kind of answer does Christianity offer to that sort of circumstance? I'm going to have Tim to read for us this passage here, Tim, if you will. 1 Peter 3, verses 1 through 7. Are your eyes in good shape today?
Yes, they are.
Okay. And then we're going to bring into this some other parts of 1 Peter as well. But just think of how not only the concept of marriage, but how odd the nature of the relationship described here will sound, and especially so when it's read in disconnection from the rest of 1 Peter. And I'll illustrate what I mean by that in a moment. Tim, would you read for us?
In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives, as they observe their chaste and respectful behavior. Your adornment must be merely external, braiding the hair and wearing gold jewelry, or putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable quality of gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. Just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her children if you do what is right, without being frightened by any fear. You husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with someone weaker, since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered.
Okay. There are some translation issues there that I would prefer to have rendered differently. But overall, What response? Suppose Tim took that passage and read it on a morning network TV program. Either of the three. What do you think would get people's attention most in that reading, and what would be the general response? By the way, it has happened recently, and I already know the answer to this. I just want to see what you think. What do you think? All right. I agree with that. That's what would, in other words, we would jump the track from a discussion about what marriage is, and immediately we would introduce other current cultural debates into it, like gender, the arguments about equality, or about feminism, or about domestic violence. Those kind of things would blur the picture, and we would forget to get back to thinking about what is being talked about here. On a recent Today Show issue, they had an interview with a woman named Gabrielle Reese. And Gabrielle Reese is a former volleyball star and a current fitness expert, and a person who they didn't expect to do this. And she made a comment about choosing to serve her family and her husband. She said that it creates a dynamic where he is in fact acting more like a man and masculine and treating me the way I want to be treated. And Brian Williams described that as a new and provocative take on how to keep a marriage together. And NBC News ran a poll about that statement, as in polls would settle it. And here, what surprised them was they got only 19% of their audience that responded to their poll who disagreed with it. That only increased the debate and the argument that went on. I saw just this morning another opinion piece written, and I'm trying to find the. This is written by a lady named Suzanne Venker, V-E-N-K-E-R, and she is a person who has written about this in books and so forth herself. And she says that the problem that people have with the word submissive is that it's a loaded term. She says it doesn't mean being less than or subordinate to one's spouse. Submission means to defer to another person's judgment, opinion, or decision. It means that you trust your partner. Now think about it that way. Have you ever considered that by the nature of this is a voluntary thing. It is not something one imposes on the other. And it means I trust this person. Now, can you be married? Can you build a successful marriage without trust? Can you indicate? Now, think about your relationship with God. Can you indicate or practice trust without being willing to say, all right, because you're you and we're us, I'm going to cooperate with this. You see, that's the idea that's involved. That's how much the society, I think, is unprepared. Now, let's work our way through 1 Peter a little bit. And I want to try to sort of make some what I think would be fairly obvious observation, see what you think about them. In this book, this discussion is still a part of this. It's about holiness. Remember our theme, the Pilgrim Church? We are sojourners and pilgrims in this world. We are a people for God's own possession. We have been set apart as a holy nation. And in 1 Peter 1, verse 14, following verse 15, along in there, verse 16, the theme is established here that we're to be holy as God is holy. And what the instruction of this letter is telling us is how to do that. What does this mean in practice? And the idea of holiness brought to how we treat marriage is necessary equipment for success. What would you say the culture generally thinks that marriage is about? I thought you would say this immediately, especially you guys. Happiness. All right? Isn't that right? Generally, people think you marry in order to be happy. It's about happiness. And this is the first place where we are different. As Christians, we believe that respect for holiness and the pursuit of holiness gives us more of a chance to be both holy and happy than developing human relationships simply for happiness does. Doing things simply for happiness is a self-defeating thing. It keeps you from, it ends up keeping you from being either holy or happy. And the reason is we are human beings who all are imperfect. And if you start out with your perfect match, you are still going to confront Monday morning sometime in your marriage. And of course, I can. All of us in here are a little older than the common crowd thinking about marriage, but all of us except Casey here. But the idea that because we love each other, we'll never irritate each other is a thought that belongs to the world and not to the church.
Even I'm too old for that.
Oh, okay. You see what I'm talking about, though, don't you? How do we face a relationship? How do we provide for a relationship which is not simply another thing about us? And how do we relate to another human being in such a way that we don't devalue the other human being and simply use them as long as they satisfy us? That's what God is trying to provide for us, and that's the way Christians see marriage. And that's the first thing that really sets us apart in how we look at this whole situation. All right, y'all are free to interrupt. I'm not going to give you a chance. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand. But if you have a comment.
I think you just said it, but to me, when you start talking about happiness, you end up focusing, like you said, on me and not making the other person happy too.
That's true.
And it's not about us anymore.
All right. Does God want us to be happy? Absolutely He does. He's trying to tell us, though, this gives you the best chance of achieving that in your life. Now, it's about holiness. And second, takes Christ as its model. This also is important, and this ties chapter 3 here to the end of chapter 2. Everybody please note that what Peter does at the end of chapter 2, especially in verse 21, he's talking about maybe doing good and suffering for it. And I don't mean to say that that's what marriage is about. You do good and you suffer for it. But I do think that in order to be married, in order to relate to an imperfect human being, you have to be able to be patient. You have to be able to be gracious. You have to be able to forbear. Or that surely isn't what Kay has to deal with. Don't we all? Isn't that right? And what he's saying, for to this you've been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you the example that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. All right, now, why did he do that? Because he loved. We're told in Ephesians 5 that Christ loved himself and gave himself up for us, that for the church, that he loved the church and gave himself up for us. I said that wrong, didn't I? So that becomes the model that is used here. Now, what does that attitude, verses 21 through 23, how does that act in a relationship like marriage, a commitment to another person's good?
I think it's explained in verse 4 of 1 Peter 3, the hidden man of the heart, which is not corruptible,
yeah.
A meek and quiet spirit.
All right, I want to talk about that a little bit more in a second here, but I think that's exactly right. The idea is that we relate to even situations that seem unfair to us or that don't work out like we want them to, without it descending into a returning, reviling, threatening, anger. Type situation. In other words, this is where one person, instead of simply guarding his own turf, is seeking to be a blessing to others, the other person in the situation. All right, I'm hoping you see what I'm getting at here, that this statement about marriage doesn't just burst on the scene. All right, now, number 3. Think about this. It's talking to me. Now, what do I mean by that? I don't want a show of hands here. But have you ever seen, or have you ever thought a tendency to want to read one of these passages to your mate? All right. Where a husband then wants to take 1 Peter 3 verses 1 through 6 and say, look here, woman, you're supposed to do this. And it would be, you choose whichever verse seems to be more relevant, of course. It could either be, call me Lord, or be quiet, or obey me. You see that? Or where the wife wants to read to the husband and tell him, you're supposed to treat me like your equal. Verse 7 says that. Here is a key factor to all biblical teaching about the marriage relationship. Every person ought to read the passages that are talking to him or her. Why? Okay, don't measure your corn in somebody else's basket. I wish I'd thought to put it that way. Somebody would give me a lot of grief if I could have said that.
You can't change another person.
All right. That's the only part you can do is what it says to you. You can't be your wife, or she can't be you, or do what it says for you to do, or make you do what it says for you to do. It always is talking to me. That's the first thing. All right. Number 4. Is this starting to sound like a sermon to you guys? Yeah. I was afraid it might. You think about this. I'll go a little more quickly with this now. It emphasizes, that's not really the way I say it, I won't say it here, but it values the inward person. Inward beauty is the key quality of marriage. All right. In our world, how is that different? All right, you notice if you start with the idea that it's about happiness, then it means that how I either outward beauty, style, attractiveness or whatever is the key quality in it. And what the Christian viewpoint says is, look here, a gentle and a quiet spirit, which is characterized by holiness, is the ingredient in marriage that allows it to thrive. The inward person is the key quality to it. Number 5 here, and I know the time will make this impossible, but I want you to notice here that it requires I'll use cooperation and consideration here. I think the submission that we talked about in verse that we talk about in verse 1, it has to be matched by the consideration that is demanded of the husband in verse 7. Does everyone see what I'm getting at? It requires both cooperation and consideration. And the statement for the wife, and it's interesting how in these teachings in the New Testament letters, it always starts with the wife. The wife, her willingness to trust, to be subject to, has to be matched by the husband's understanding and his showing consideration. That generally speaking, physically at least, the female will be the less physically imposing vessel of the two. And that's the idea here, that both cooperation and consideration is involved. This means it assumes equality. In terms of human worth as individuals, the fact that both parties can be addressed and spoken to and held responsible means that both are equal in terms of their beings. And then, next, it is based on otherness. I needed to say a lot more time for this than we have here. And what I mean by that is the biblical concept of marriage is based on the idea that there is the male and the female. There is otherness both physically and emotionally and spiritually involved in the meaning of marriage. One of the current books I've seen is by Timothy Keller. He ties it to the meaning of marriage. He's worked in the New York City area for over 25 years. And he says that during that period of time, he has become convinced that this part of marriage is the part that is most misunderstood in our culture. And he believes that where same-sex situations exist, that often it is because of a fear of the otherness. And he says that he's had individuals that he's counseled with over the years admit that to him, a fear of otherness. We're other from each other so that we may be complements to each other. That's the Christian viewpoint, and that this is a necessary thing, and that God made us male and female. God, in the beginning, God created mankind in His own image, male and female. He made them. Remember, Galatians 1 or Genesis 1, and that it takes both male and female to make the union that reflects the wholeness of God, and that's not a statement of hate or of animosity. It's a statement of faith in God who made us. All right. Sorry, I used up all the time, but not so sorry that I wouldn't do it. You guys have a good week, and please don't tell Kay anything I said.